alarm my father and myself. Did your father speak of it? Inquired Mercedes eagerly.
No, madame. But do you not remember that he remarked the fact to you?
Yes, I do remember, replied the countess.
A servant entered, summoned by Albert's ring of the bell.
Take these flowers into the anteroom or dressing room, said the Viscount. They make the countess unwell.
The footman obeyed his orders. A long pause ensued, which lasted until all the flowers were removed.
What is this name of Monte Cristo? Inquired the countess, when the servant had taken away the last vase of flowers. Is it a family name, or the name of the estate, or a simple title?
I believe, mother, it is merely a simple title. The count purchased an island in the Tuscan archipelago, and, as he told you today, has founded a commandery. You know the same thing was done for St. Stephen of Florence, St. George, Constantinian of Parma, and even for the Order of Malta. Except this, he has no pretension to nobility, and calls himself a chance count, although the general opinion at Rome is that the count is a man of very high distinction.
His manners are admirable, said the countess, at least as far as I could judge, in the few moments he remained here.
They are perfect, mother. So perfect that they surpass by far all I have known in the leading aristocracy of the three proudest noblesse of Europe, the English aristocracy, Spanish aristocracy, and German aristocracy. The countess paused a moment. Then, after a slight hesitation, she resumed,
You have seen, my dear Albert, I ask the question as a mother, you have seen Monsieur de Monte Cristo in his house. You are quick-sighted, have much knowledge of the world, more tact than is usual at your age. Do you think the Count is really what he appears to be?
What does he appear to be?
Why, you have just said, a man of high distinction.
I told you, my dear mother, he was esteemed such. But what is your own opinion, Albert?
I must tell you that I have not come to any decided opinion respecting him, but I think him a Maltese.
I do not ask you of his origin, but what he is.
Ah, what he is. That is quite another thing. I have seen so many remarkable things of him that if you would have me really say what I think, I shall reply that I really do look upon him as one of Byron's heroes, whom misery has marked with a fatal brand. Some Manfred, some Lara, some Werner, one of those wrecks, as it were, of some ancient family, who, disinherited of their patrimony, have achieved one by the force of their adventurous genius, which has placed them above the laws of society. You say, I say, that Monte Cristo is an island in the midst of the Mediterranean, without inhabitants or garrison, the resort of smugglers of all nations and pirates of every flag. Who knows whether or not these industrious worthies do not pay to their feudal lord some dues for his protection?
That is possible, said the countess, reflecting.
Never mind, continued the young man. Smuggler or not, you must agree, mother dear, as you have seen him, that the Count of Monte Cristo is a remarkable man who will have the greatest success in the salons of Paris. Why, this very morning at my abode, he made his entree amongst us by striking every man of us with amazement, not even excepting Chateau Renaud.
And what do you suppose is the Count's age? Inquired Mercedes, evidently attaching great importance to this question.
35 or 36, mother.
So young?
It is impossible, said Mercedes, replying at the same time to what Albert said, as well as to her own private reflection. It is the truth, however. 3 or 4 times he has said to me, and certainly without the slightest premeditation, at such a period I was 5 years old, at another 10 years old, at another 12, and I, induced by curiosity, which kept me alive to these details, have compared the dates, and never found him inaccurate. The age of this singular man, who is of no age, is then, I am certain, 35. Besides, mother, remark how vivid his eye, how raven black his hair, and his brow, though so pale, is free from wrinkles. He is not only vigorous, but also young.
The countess bent her head as if beneath a heavy wave of bitter thoughts.
And has this man displayed
a friendship for you, Albert?" she asked with a nervous shudder. "I am inclined to think so. And do you like him?"
"Why, he pleases me in spite of France d'Epernay, who tries to convince me that he is a being returned from the other world." The Countess shuddered.
"Albert," she said, in a voice which was altered by emotion, "I have always put you on your guard against new acquaintances. Now you are a man and are able to give me advice. Yet I repeat to you, Albert, be prudent."
"Why, my dear mother, it is necessary, in order to make your advice turn to account, that I should know beforehand what I have to distrust. The Count never plays. He only drinks pure water, tinged with a little sherry, and is so rich that he cannot, without intending to laugh at me, try to borrow money. What, then, have I to fear from him?"
"You are right," said the Countess, "and my fears are weakness, especially when directed against a man who has saved your life. How did your father receive him, Albert? It is necessary that we should be more than complaisant to the Count. Monsieur de Morcerf is sometimes occupied. His business makes him reflective, and he might, without intending it, nothing could be in better taste than my father's demeanour, madame," said Albert. "Nay, more, he seemed greatly flattered at two or three compliments which the Count very skilfully and agreeably paid him with as much ease as if he had known him these 30 years. Each of these little tickling arrows must have pleased my father," added Albert with a laugh, "and thus they parted the best possible friends, and Monsieur de Morcerf even wished to take him to the chamber to hear the speakers." The Countess made no reply. She fell into so deep a reverie that her eyes gradually closed. The young man, standing up before her, gazed upon her with that filial affection which is so tender and endearing with children whose mothers are still young and handsome. Then, after seeing her eyes closed and hearing her breathe gently, he believed she had dropped asleep and left the apartment on tiptoe, closing the door after him with the utmost precaution. "This devil of a fellow," he muttered, shaking his head. "I said at the time he would create a sensation here, and I measure his effect by an infallible thermometer. My mother has noticed him, and he must therefore, perforce, be remarkable."
43. Monsieur Bertuccio. During this time the Count had arrived at his house. It had taken him 6 minutes to perform the distance, but these 6 minutes were sufficient to induce 20 young men who knew the price of the equipage they had been unable to purchase themselves to put their horses into a gallop in order to see the rich foreigner who could afford to give 20,000 francs apiece for his horses. The house Ali had chosen, and which was to serve as a town residence to Monte Cristo, was situated on the right hand as you ascended the Champs-Élysées. A thick clump of trees and shrubs rose in the centre and masked a portion of the front. Around this shrubbery, two alleys like two arms extended right and left, and formed a carriage drive from the iron gates to a double portico, on every step of which stood a porcelain vase filled with flowers. This house, isolated from the rest, had, besides the main entrance, another in the Rue Pontieu. Even before the coachman had hailed the concierge, the massy gates rolled on their hinges. They had seen the Count coming, and at Paris, as everywhere else, he was served with the rapidity of lightning. The coachman entered and traversed the half-circle without slackening his speed. The gates were closed ere the wheels had ceased to sound on the gravel. The carriage stopped at the left side of the portico. Two men presented themselves at the carriage window. The one was Ali, who, smiling with an expression of the most sincere joy, seemed amply repaid by a mere look from Monte Cristo. The other bowed respectfully and offered his arm to assist the Count in descending. "Thanks, Monsieur Bertuccio," said the Count, springing lightly up the three steps of the portico. "And the notary?"
"He is in the small salon, Excellency," returned Bertuccio. "And the cards I ordered to have engraved as soon as you knew the number of the house? Monsieur le Comte, it is done already. I have been myself to the best engraver of the Palais Royal, who did the plate in my presence.
The first card struck off was taken, according to your orders, to Monsieur le Baron Danglars, Rue de la Chaussée-d'Antin, number 7. The others are on the mantelpiece of your Excellency's bedroom. Good. What o'clock is it?
4 o'clock.
Monte Cristo gave his hat, cane, and gloves to the same French footman who had called his carriage at the Comte de Morcerf's, and then he passed into the small salon, preceded by Bertuccio, who showed him the way.
"These are but indifferent marbles in this antechamber," said Monte Cristo. "I trust all this will soon be taken away."
Bertuccio bowed. As the steward had said, the notary awaited him in the small salon. He was a simple-looking lawyer's clerk, elevated to the extraordinary dignity of a provincial scrivener.
"You are the notary empowered to sell the country house that I wish to purchase, monsieur?" asked Monte Cristo.
"Yes, monsieur le comte,"
returned the notary.
"Is the deed of sale ready?"
"Yes, monsieur le comte. Here it is."
"Very well.
And where is this house that I purchase?" asked the count carelessly, addressing himself half to Bertuccio, half to the notary. The steward made a gesture that signified, "I do not know." The notary looked at the count with astonishment.
"What?" said he. "Does not monsieur le comte know where the house he purchases is situated?"
"How should I know it? I have arrived from Cadiz this morning. I have never before been at Paris, and it is the first time I have ever even set my foot in France."
"Ah, that is different. The house you purchase is situated at Auteuil."
At these words Bertuccio turned pale.
"And where is Auteuil?" asked the count.
"Close by here, monsieur," replied the notary, "a little beyond Passy. A charming situation in the heart of the Bois de Boulogne."
"So near as that?" said the count. "But that is not in the country. What made you choose a house at the gates of Paris, Monsieur Bertuccio?"
"I?" cried the steward with a strange expression. "Monsieur le comte did not charge me to purchase this house. If Monsieur le comte will recollect, if he will think..."
"Ah, true," observed Monte Cristo. "I recollect now. I read the advertisement in one of the papers and was tempted by the false title, 'A Country House.'"
"It is not yet too late," cried Bertuccio eagerly, "and if your Excellency will entrust me with the commission, I will find you a better at Angers, at Fontenay-aux-Roses, or at Bellevue."
"Oh, no," returned Monte Cristo negligently. "Since I have this, I will keep it."
"And you are quite right," said the notary, who feared to lose his fee. "It is a charming place, well supplied with spring water and fine trees, a comfortable habitation, although abandoned for a long time, without reckoning the furniture, which, although old, is yet valuable, now that old things are so much sought after. I suppose Monsieur le comte has the tastes of the day?"
"To be sure," returned Monte Cristo. "It is very convenient, then.
It is more. It is magnificent."
"Peste! Let us not lose such an opportunity," returned Monte Cristo. "The deed, if you please, Monsieur le Notaire."
And he signed it rapidly, after having first ran his eye over that part of the deed in which were specified the situation of the house and the names of the proprietors.
"Bertuccio," said he, "give 55,000 francs to monsieur."
The steward left the room with a faltering step, and returned with a bundle of banknotes, which the notary counted like a man who never gives a receipt for money until after legal examination.
"And now," demanded the count, "are all the forms complied with?"
"All, monsieur le comte.
Have you the keys?"
"They are in the hands of the concierge, who takes care of the house. But here is the order I have given him to install Monsieur le comte in his new possession."
"Very well." And Monte Cristo made a sign with his hand to the notary, which said, "I have no further need of you. You may go."
"But," observed the honest notary, "you are mistaken, I think, Monsieur le comte. It is only 50,000 francs, everything included."
"And your fee
is included in this sum."
"But have you not come from Auteuil here?"
"Yes, certainly."
"Well, then, it is but fair that you should be paid for your loss of time and trouble," said the count, and he made a gesture of polite dismissal. The notary left the room backwards and bowing down to the ground. It was the first time he had ever met a similar client.
"See this gentleman out," said the count to Bertuccio.
and the steward followed the notary out of the room. Scarcely was the count alone when he drew from his pocket a book closed with a lock and opened it with the key which he wore round his neck and which never left him. After having sought for a few minutes, he stopped at a leaf which had several notes and compared them with the deed of sale which lay on the table, and recalling his souvenir, "Auteuil, Rue de la Fontaine, number 28. It is indeed the same," said he. "And now, am I to rely upon an avowal extorted by religious or physical terror? However, in an hour I shall know all." "Bertuccio," cried he, striking a light hammer with a pliant handle on a small gong. "Bertuccio!" The steward appeared at the door. "Monsieur Bertuccio," said the count, "did you never tell me that you had travelled in France?"
"In some parts of France, yes, Excellency."
"You know the environs of Paris, then?"
"No, Excellency, no," returned the steward with a sort of nervous trembling, which Monte Cristo, a connoisseur in all emotions, rightly attributed to great disquietude.
"It is unfortunate," returned he, "that you have never visited the environs, for I wish to see my new property this evening, and had you gone with me, you could have given me some useful information."
"To Auteuil?" cried Bertuccio, whose copper complexion became livid. "I go to Auteuil? Well, what is there surprising in that? When I live at Auteuil, you must come there, as you belong to my service." Bertuccio hung down his head before the imperious look of his master, and remained motionless, without making any answer.
"Why, what has happened to you? Are you going to make me ring a second time for the carriage?" asked Monte Cristo, in the same tone that Louis XIV pronounced the famous, "I have been almost obliged to wait." Bertuccio made but one bound to the antechamber, and cried out in a hoarse voice, "His Excellency's horses!" Monte Cristo wrote two or three notes, and as he sealed the last, the steward appeared. "Your Excellency's carriage is at the door," said he.
"Well, take your hat and gloves," returned Monte Cristo.
"Am I to accompany you, Monsieur le Comte?" cried Bertuccio.
"Certainly. You must give your orders, for I intend residing at the house."
It was unexampled for a servant of the Count's to dare to dispute an order of his, so the steward, without saying a word, followed his master, who got into the carriage and signed him to follow, which he did, seating himself respectfully on the front seat. 44. The House at Auteuil. Monte Cristo had remarked that, as they descended the staircase, Bertuccio signed himself in the Corsican manner, that is, had formed the sign of the cross in the air with his thumb, and, as he seated himself in the carriage, muttered a short prayer. Anyone but a curious man would have had pity on seeing the steward's extraordinary repugnance for the Count's projected drive extra muros. But it seemed the Count was too curious to excuse Bertuccio this little journey. In 20 minutes they were at Auteuil. The steward's emotion had continued to augment as they entered the village. Bertuccio, crouched in a corner of the carriage, began to examine with a feverish anxiety every house they passed. "Tell them to stop at Rue de la Fontaine, number 28, said the Count, fixing his eyes on the steward, to whom he gave this order. Bertuccio's forehead was covered with perspiration, but, however, he obeyed, and leaning out of the window, he cried to the coachman, "Rue de la Fontaine, number 28. Number 28 was situated at the extremity of the village. During the drive, night had set in, and a black cloud, charged with electricity, gave to the surroundings the appearance and solemnity of a dramatic episode. The carriage stopped, the footman sprang off the box, and opened the door. "Well," said the Count, "you do not get out, Monsieur Bertuccio? You are going to stay in the carriage, then? What are you thinking of this evening?" Bertuccio sprang out and offered his shoulder to the Count, who, this time, leaned upon it as he descended the three steps of the carriage. "Knock," said the Count, "and announce me." Bertuccio knocked, the door opened, and the concierge appeared.
"What is it?" asked he.
"It is your new master, my good fellow," said the footman, and he held out to the concierge the notary's order.
"The house is sold, then?" demanded the concierge. "'And this gentleman is coming to live here?'
"'Yes, my friend,' returned the Count, "'and I will endeavour to give you no cause to regret your old master.'
"'Oh, monsieur,' said the concierge, "'I shall not have much cause to regret him, for he came here but seldom. "'It is 5 years since he was here last, and he did well to sell the house, "'for it did not bring him in anything at all.
"'What was the name of your old master?' said Monte Cristo.
"'Monsieur le Marquis de Saint-Mérin. "'Ah, I am sure he has not sold the house for what he gave for it.'
"'The Marquis de Saint-Mérin,' returned the Count. "'The name is not unknown to me. "'The Marquis de Saint-Mérin.' "'And he appeared to meditate.
"'An old gentleman,' continued the concierge, "'a staunch follower of the Bourbons. "'He had an only daughter who married Monsieur de Villefort, "'who had been the Procureur du Roi at Nîmes, "'and afterwards at Versailles.'
Monte Cristo glanced at Bertuccio, who became whiter than the wall against which he leaned to prevent himself from falling.
"'And is not this daughter dead?' demanded Monte Cristo.
"'I fancy I have heard so.'
"'Yes, monsieur, 21 years ago, and since then we have not seen the poor Marquis 3 times.'
"'Thanks,' said Monte Cristo, judging from the steward's utter prostration that he could not stretch the cords further without danger of breaking it. "'Give me a light.'
"'Shall I accompany you, monsieur?'
"'No, it is unnecessary. Bertuccio will show me a light.' And Monte Cristo accompanied these words by the gift of 2 pieces of gold, which produced a torrent of thanks and blessings from the concierge.
"'Ah, monsieur,' said he, after having vainly searched on the mantelpiece and the shelves, "'I have not got any candles.'
"'Take one of the carriage lamps, Bertuccio,' said the Count, "'and show me the apartments.' The steward obeyed in silence. But it was easy to see from the manner in which the hand that held the light trembled how much it cost him to obey. They went over a tolerably large ground floor, a first floor consisting of a salon, a bathroom, and 2 bedrooms. By one of these bedrooms they arrived at a winding staircase that opened onto the garden.
"'Ah, here is a private staircase,' said the Count. "'That is convenient.' "'Light me, Monsieur Bertuccio, and go first. "'We will see where it leads to.'
"'Monsieur,' replied Bertuccio, "'it leads to the garden.'
"'And pray, how do you know that?'
"'It ought to do so, at least.'
"'Well, let us be sure of that.'
Bertuccio sighed and went on first. The stairs led, in reality, to the garden. At the outer door the steward paused.
"'Go on, Monsieur Bertuccio,' said the Count.
But he to whom he spoke was stupefied, bewildered, stunned. His haggard eyes glanced around, as if in search of the traces of some terrible event, and with his clenched hands he seemed striving to shut out some horrible recollections.
"Well?" insisted the Count.
"No, no," cried Bertuccio, setting down the lantern at the angle of the interior wall.
"No, monsieur, it is impossible. I can go no further."
"'What does this mean?' demanded the irresistible voice of Monte Cristo.
"'Why, you must see, Monsieur le Comte,' cried the steward, "'that this is not natural, that having a house to purchase, you purchase it exactly at Auteuil, and that purchasing it at Auteuil, this house should be number 28 Rue de la Fontaine. Oh, why did I not tell you all? I am sure you would not have forced me to come.' I hoped your house would have been some other one than this, as if there was not another house at Auteuil than that of the assassination.
Ah, ah, cried Monte Cristo, stopping suddenly.
What words did you utter? Devil of a man, Corsican that you are, always mysteries or superstitions. Come, take the lantern, and let us visit the garden. You are not afraid of ghosts with me, I hope?
Bertuccio raised the lantern and obeyed. The door, as it opened, disclosed a gloomy sky, in which the moon strove vainly to struggle through a sea of clouds that covered her with their sombre wave, that she illumined for an instant and was then lost in the darkness. The steward wished to turn to the left.
"'No, no, monsieur,' said Monte Cristo. "'What is the use of following the alleys? Here is a beautiful lawn. Let us go on, straight forward.'
Bertuccio wiped the perspiration from his brow, but obeyed.
However, he continued to take the left hand. Monte Cristo, on the contrary, took the right hand. Arriving near a clump of trees, he stopped. The steward could not restrain himself.
"Move, monsieur. Move away, I entreat you. You are exactly in the spot."
"What spot?"
"Where he fell."
"My dear Monsieur Bertuccio," said Monte Cristo, laughing, "recover yourself. We are no longer at Sartène or at Corte. This is not a marquee, but an English garden. Badly kept, I own, but still you must not calumniate it for that. Monsieur, I implore you, do not stay there."
"I think you are going mad, Bertuccio," said the Count coldly. "If that is the case, I warn you, I shall have you put in a lunatic asylum."
"Alas, Excellency," returned Bertuccio, joining his hands and shaking his head in a manner that would have excited the Count's laughter had not thoughts of a superior interest occupied him and rendered him attentive to the least revelation of this timorous conscience.
"Alas, Excellency, the evil has arrived."
"Monsieur Bertuccio," said the Count, "I knew you were a Corsican. I knew you were gloomy and always brooding over some old history of the vendetta, and I overlooked that in Italy, because in Italy those things are thought nothing of. But in France they are considered in very bad taste. There are gendarmes who occupy themselves with such affairs, judges who condemn, and scaffolds which avenge."
Bertuccio clasped his hands, and as in all these evolutions he did not let fall the lantern, the light showed his pale and altered countenance.
Monte Cristo examined him with the same look that, at Rome, had viewed the execution of Andrea, and then, in a tone that made a shudder pass through the veins of the poor steward,
"The Abbe Busoni, then, told me an untruth," said he, "when, after his journey in France in 1829, he sent you to me with a letter of recommendation in which he enumerated all your valuable qualities.
Well, I shall write to the abbe. I shall render him responsible for his protégé's misconduct, and I shall soon know all about this assassination. Only I warn you that when I reside in a country, I conform to all its code, and I have no wish to put myself within the compass of the French laws for your sake."
"Oh, do not do that, Excellency. I have always served you faithfully," cried Bertuccio in despair. "I have always been an honest man, and, as far as lay in my power, I have done good."
"I do not deny it," returned the Count. "But why are you thus agitated? It is a bad sign. A quiet conscience does not occasion such paleness in the cheeks and such fear in the hands of a man."
"But, Monsieur le Comte," replied Bertuccio hesitatingly, "did not Monsieur l'Abbé Busoni, who heard my confession in the prison at Nîmes, tell you I had a heavy reproach to make against myself?"
"Yes, but as he said you would make an excellent steward, I concluded you had stolen. That was all."
"Ah, Monsieur le Comte," returned Bertuccio contemptuously,
"or, as you are a Corsican, that you had been unable to resist the desire of making a pot, as you call it."
"Yes, my good master," cried Bertuccio, casting himself at the Count's feet, "it was simply a vengeance, nothing else. I understand that. But I do not understand what it is that galvanizes you in this manner."
"But, monsieur, it is very natural," returned Bertuccio, "since it was in this house that my vengeance was accomplished."
"What had you to revenge on the Marquis de Saint-Marin?"
"Oh, it was not on him, monsieur. It was on another."
"This is strange," returned Monte Cristo, seeming to yield to his reflections, "that you should find yourself without any preparation in a house where the event happened that causes you so much remorse."
"Monsieur," said the steward, "it is fatality, I am sure. First, you purchase a house at Auteuil. This house is the one where I have committed an assassination. You descend to the garden by the same staircase by which he descended. You stop at the spot where he received the blow, and two paces farther is the grave in which he had just buried his child. This is not chance, for chance in this case resembles providence too much."
"Well, Monsieur le Corse, let us suppose it is providence. I always suppose anything people please, and besides, you must concede something to diseased minds. Come, collect yourself, and tell me all."
"I have related it but once, and that was to the Abbe Busoni.
Such things, continued Bertuccio, shaking his head, are only related under the seal of confession.
Then, said the Count, I refer you to your confessor. Turn Chartreux or Trappist and relate your secrets. But as for me, I do not like anyone who is alarmed by such phantasms, and I do not choose that my servant should be afraid to walk in the garden of an evening.
I confess I am not very desirous of a visit from the Commissaire de Police, for in Italy justice is only paid when silent. In France she is paid only when she speaks. Peste! I thought you somewhat Corsican, a great smuggler and an excellent steward, but I see you have other strings to your bow. You are no longer in my service, Monsieur Bertuccio.
Oh, Monsieur Lecon, Monsieur Lecon, cried the steward, struck with terror at this threat. If that is the only reason I cannot remain in your service, I will tell all, for if I quit you, it will only be to go to the scaffold.
That is different, replied Monte Cristo. But if you intend to tell an untruth, reflect it were better not to speak at all.
No, monsieur, I swear to you, by my hopes of salvation, I will tell you all, for the Abbe Busoni himself only knew a part of my secret. But, I pray you, go away from that plane tree. The moon is just bursting through the clouds, and there, standing where you do, and wrapped in that cloak that conceals your figure, you remind me of Monsieur de Villefort.
What? Cried Monte Cristo. It was Monsieur de Villefort? Your Excellency knows him? The former Procureur du Roi at Nîmes?
Yes. Who married the Comte de Saint-Marin's daughter?
Yes. Who enjoyed the reputation of being the most severe, the most upright, the most rigid magistrate on the bench?
Well, monsieur, said Bertuccio, this man with this spotless reputation,
well, was a villain.
Bah, replied Monte Cristo. Impossible. It is as I tell you.
Ah, really, said Monte Cristo. Have you the proof of this?
I had it, and you have lost it.
How stupid.
Yes, but by careful search it might be recovered.
Really, returned the Count.
Relate it to me, for it begins to interest me.
And the Count, humming an air from Lucia di Lammermoor, went to sit down on a bench, whilst Bertuccio followed him, collecting his thoughts. Bertuccio remained standing before him. 45. The Vendetta.
From what point shall I commence my story, Monsieur le Comte? Asked Bertuccio.
From where you please, returned Monte Cristo, since I know nothing at all of it.
I thought Monsieur l'Abbé Busoni had told your Excellency.
Some particulars, doubtless, but that is 7 or 8 years ago, and I have forgotten them.
Then I can speak without fear of tiring your Excellency.
Go on, Monsieur Bertuccio. You will supply the want of the evening papers.
The story begins in 1815.
Ah, said Monte Cristo. 1815 is not yesterday.
No, monsieur.
And yet I recollect all things as clearly as if they had happened but then. I had a brother, an elder brother, who was in the service of the Emperor. He had become lieutenant in a regiment composed entirely of Corsicans. This brother was my only friend. We became orphans, I at 5, he at 18. He brought me up as if I had been his son, and in 1814 he married. When the Emperor returned from the island of Elba, my brother instantly joined the army, was slightly wounded at Waterloo, and retired with the army behind the Loire.
But that is the history of the 100 days, Monsieur Bertuccio, said the Count. Unless I am mistaken, it has been already written.
Excuse me, Excellency, but these details are necessary, and you promised to be patient.
Go on. I will keep my word.
One day we received a letter. I should tell you that we lived in the little village of Rogliano, at the extremity of Cape Corso. This letter was from my brother. He told us that the army was disbanded, and that he should return by Châteauroux, Clermont-Ferrand, Le Puy, and Nîmes, and if I had any money, he prayed me to leave it for him at Nîmes, with an innkeeper with whom I had dealings.
In the smuggling line? Said Monte Cristo.
Monsieur le Comte, everyone must live.
Certainly.
Continue. I loved my brother tenderly, as I told your Excellency, and I resolved not to send the money, but to take it to him myself. I possessed 1,000 francs, £40. I left 500 with Assunta, my sister-in-law, and with the other 500 I set off for Nîmes. It was easy to do, and as I had my boat and a lading to take in at sea, everything favoured my project. But after we had taken in our cargo, the wind became contrary, so that we were 4 or 5 days without being able to enter the Rhone. At last, however, we succeeded and worked up to Arles. I left the boat between Bellegarde and Beaucaire and took the road to Nîmes. We are getting to the story now. Yes, Your Excellency. Excuse me, but as you will see, I only tell you what is absolutely necessary. Just at this time, the famous massacres of the south of France took place. 2 or 3 brigands called Trestaillon, Truffemy, and Graffin publicly assassinated everybody whom they suspected of Bonapartism. You have doubtless heard of these massacres, Monsieur le Comte.
Vaguely. I was far from France at that period. Go on. As I entered Nîmes, I literally waded in blood. At every step you encountered dead bodies and bands of the murderers who killed, plundered, and burned. At the sight of this slaughter and devastation, I became terrified, not for myself, for I, a simple Corsican fisherman, had nothing to fear. On the contrary, that time was most favourable for us smugglers. But for my brother, a soldier of the Empire, returning from the army of the Loire, with his uniform and his epaulettes, there was everything to apprehend. I hastened to the innkeeper. My presages had been but too true. My brother had arrived the previous evening at Nîmes, and at the very door of the house where he was about to demand hospitality, he had been assassinated. I did all in my power to discover the murderers, but no one durst tell me their names, so much were they dreaded. I then thought of that French justice of which I had heard so much, and which feared nothing, and I went to the Procureur du Roi. And this Procureur du Roi was named Villefort? Asked Monte Cristo carelessly.
Yes, Your Excellency. He came from Marseille, where he had been deputy procureur. His zeal had procured him advancement, and he was said to be one of the first who had informed the government of the departure from the island of Elba.
Then, said Monte Cristo, you went to him?
Monsieur, I said, my brother was assassinated yesterday in the streets of Nîmes. I know not by whom, but it is your duty to find out. You are the head of justice here, and it is for justice to avenge those she has been unable to protect.
Who was your brother? Asked he.
A lieutenant in the Corsican battalion.
A soldier of the usurper, then. A soldier of the French army.
Well, replied he has smitten with the sword and has perished with the sword.
You are mistaken, monsieur, I replied. He has perished by the poniard.
What do you want me to do? Asked the magistrate.
I have already told you. Avenge him.
On whom?
On his murderers.
How should I know who they are?
Order them to be sought for.
Why, your brother has been involved in a quarrel and killed in a duel. All these old soldiers commit excesses which were tolerated in the time of the emperor, but which are not suffered now, for the people here do not like soldiers of such disorderly conduct.
Monsieur, I replied, it is not for myself that I entreat your interference. I should grieve for him or avenge him, but my poor brother had a wife, and were anything to happen to me, the poor creature would perish from want, for my brother's pay alone kept her. Pray, try and obtain a small government pension for her.
Every revolution has its catastrophes, returned Monsieur de Villefort. Your brother has been the victim of this. It is a misfortune, and government owes nothing to his family. If we are to judge by all the vengeance that the followers of the usurper exercised on the partisans of the king when, in their turn, they were in power, your brother would be today, in all probability, condemned to death. What has happened is quite natural, and is only the law of reprisals.
What, cried I, do you, a magistrate, speak thus to me?
All these Corsicans are mad on my honour, replied Monsieur de Villefort. They fancy that their countryman is still emperor. You have mistaken the time. You should have told me this 2 months ago. It is too late now. Depart instantly, or I will compel you to do so.
I looked at him an instant to see if, by renewed entreaties, there was anything to hope. But this man was of stone. I approached him and said in a low voice, Well,
since you know the Corsicans so well, you know that they always keep their word. You think that it was a good deed to kill my brother, who was a Bonapartist, because you are a royalist. Well, I, who am a Bonapartist also, declare one thing to you, which is that I will kill you. From this moment, I declare the vendetta against you. So protect yourself as well as you can, for the next time we meet, your last hour has come. And before he had recovered from his surprise, I opened the door and left the room. Ah, ah, said Monte Cristo. With your innocent appearance, you do those things, Monsieur Bertuccio. And to a procureur du roi. Moreover, did he know what was meant by this terrible word, vendetta? He knew so well that from this moment he shut himself in his house and never went out unattended, seeking me high and low. Fortunately, I was so well concealed that he could not find me. Then he became alarmed and dared not reside any longer at Nîmes, so he solicited a change of residence, and as he was in reality very influential, he was nominated to Versailles. But as you know, a Corsican who has sworn to avenge himself cares not for distance. So his carriage, fast as it went, was never above half a day's journey before me, who followed him on foot. The most important thing was not to kill him only, for I had an opportunity of doing so 100 times, but to kill him without being discovered, at least without being arrested. I no longer belonged to myself, for I had my sister-in-law to protect and provide for. During 3 months I watched Monsieur de Villefort. For 3 months he took not a step out of doors without my following him. At length I discovered that he went mysteriously to Auteuil. I followed him thither, and I saw him enter the house where we now are. Only, instead of entering by the great door that looks into the street, he came on horseback or in his carriage, left the one or the other at the little inn, and entered by the gate you see there. Monte Cristo made a sign with his head that he could discern amid the darkness the door to which Bertuccio alluded. As I had nothing more to do at Versailles, I went to Auteuil and gained all the information I could. If I wished to surprise him, it was evident this was the spot to lie in wait for him. The house belonged, as the concierge informed your excellency, to Monsieur de Saint-Marin, Villefort's father-in-law. Monsieur de Saint-Marin lived at Marseille, so that this country house was useless to him, and it was reported to be let to a young widow known only by the name of the Baroness. One evening, as I was looking over the wall, I saw a young and handsome woman who was walking alone in that garden, which was not overlooked by any windows, and I guessed that she was awaiting Monsieur de Villefort. When she was sufficiently near to distinguish her features, I saw she was from 18 to 19, tall and very fair. As she had a loose muslin dress on, and as nothing concealed her figure, I saw she would ere long become a mother. A few moments after, the little door was opened, and a man entered. The young female hastened to meet him. They threw themselves into each other's arms, embraced tenderly, and returned together to the house. This man was Monsieur de Villefort. I fully believe that when he went out in the night, he would be forced to traverse the whole of the garden alone. "And," asked the Count, "did you ever know the name of this woman?" "No, Excellency," returned Bertuccio. "You will see, I had not time to learn it." "Go on." "That evening," continued Bertuccio, "I could have killed the procureur du roi, but as I was not sufficiently master of the localities, I was fearful of not killing him on the spot, and that should his cries give the alarm, I could not escape. I put it off until the next occasion, and in order that nothing should escape me, I took a chamber looking into the street along which ran the wall of the garden. 3 days after, about 7 o'clock in the evening, I saw a servant on horseback leave the house at full gallop and take the road that led to Sèvres. I conjectured he was going to Versailles, and I was not deceived. 3 hours after, the man returned, covered with dust. His errand was performed, and 10 minutes after, another man on foot, muffled in a mantle, opened the little door of the garden, which he closed after him. I descended rapidly. Although I had not seen Villefort's face, I recognized him by the beating of my heart. I crossed the street and stopped at a post placed at the angle of the wall, and by means of which I had once before looked into the garden. This time I did not content myself with looking, but
I took my knife out of my pocket, felt that the point was sharp, and sprang over the wall. My first care was to run to the door. He had left the key in it, taking the simple precaution of turning it twice in the lock. Nothing, then, preventing my escape by this means. I examined the localities. The garden formed a long square. A terrace of smooth turf extended in the middle, and at the corners were tufts of trees with thick and massy foliage that mingled with the shrubs and flowers. In order to go from the door to the house, or from the house to the door, Monsieur de Villefort was compelled to pass by one of these clumps. It was the end of September. The wind blew violently. The faint glimpses of the pale moon, hidden at every instant by the masses of dark clouds that were sweeping across the sky, whitened the gravelled walks that led to the house, but were unable to pierce the obscurity of the thick shrubberies in which a man could conceal himself without any fear of discovery. I hid myself in the one nearest to the path Villefort must take, and scarcely was I there when, amidst the gusts of wind, I fancied I heard groans. But you know, or rather you do not know, Monsieur le Comte, that he who is about to commit an assassination fancies he hears low cries perpetually ringing in his ears. 2 hours passed thus, during which I imagined I heard these moans repeated. Midnight struck. As the last stroke died away, I saw a faint light shine through the windows of the private staircase by which we have just descended. The door opened, and the man in the mantle reappeared. The terrible moment had come, but I had so long been prepared for it that my heart did not fail in the least. I drew my knife from my pocket again, opened it, and prepared myself to strike. The man in the mantle advanced towards me, but as he drew near, I saw he had a weapon in his hand. I was afraid not of a struggle, but of a failure. When he was only a few paces from me, I saw that what I had taken for a weapon was only a spade. I was still unable to divine for what reason Monsieur de Villefort had this spade in his hands when he stopped close to the clump, glanced round, and began to dig a hole in the earth. I then perceived that he hid something beneath his mantle, which he laid on the grass in order to dig more freely. Then, I confess, curiosity became mixed with my hatred. I wished to see what Villefort was going to do there, and I remained motionless and holding my breath. Then an idea crossed my mind, which was confirmed when I saw the procureur du roi lift from under his mantle a box 2 feet long and 6 or 8 inches deep. I let him place the box in the hole he had made. Then, whilst he stamped with his feet to remove all traces of his occupation, I rushed on him and plunged my knife into his breast, exclaiming, "I am Giovanni Bertuccio, thy death for my brothers, thy treasure for his widow. Thou seest that my vengeance is more complete than I had hoped." I know not if he heard these words. I think he did not, for he fell without a cry. I felt his blood gush over my face, but I was intoxicated. I was delirious, and the blood refreshed instead of burning me. In a second I had disinterred the box. Then, that it might not be known I had done so, I filled up the hole, threw the spade over the wall, and rushed through the door, which I double-locked, carrying off the key. "Ah," said Monte Cristo, "it seems to me this was only a murder and robbery." "No, Your Excellency," returned Bertuccio. "It was a vendetta followed by a restitution." "And was the sum a large one?" "It was not money." "Ah, I recollect," replied the Count. "Did you not say something of an infant?" "Yes, Excellency." I hastened to the river, sat down on the bank, and with my knife forced open the lock of the box. In a fine linen cloth was wrapped a newborn child. Its purple visage and its violet-coloured hands showed it had perished from suffocation. But, as it was not yet cold, I hesitated to throw it into the water that ran at my feet. In reality, at the end of an instant, I fancied I felt a slight pulsation of the heart, and as I had been assistant at the hospital at Bastia, I did what a doctor would have done. I inflated the lungs by blowing air into them, and at the expiration of a quarter of an hour, I saw the breathing commence, and a feeble cry was heard. In my turn, I uttered a cry, but a cry of joy. "God has not cursed me, then," I cried, "since he permits me to save the life of a human creature in exchange for the life I have taken away."
"And what did you do with the child?" asked Monte Cristo.
It was an embarrassing load for a man seeking to escape. I had not for a moment the idea of keeping it, but I knew that at Paris there was an hospital where they received these poor creatures. As I passed the barrier, I declared I had found the child on the road, and I inquired where the hospital was. The box confirmed my statement. The linen proved it belonged to wealthy parents. The blood with which I was covered might have proceeded from the child as well as from anyone else. No objection was raised, but they pointed out to me the hospital, which was situated at the upper end of the Rue d'Enfer, and after having taken the precaution of cutting the linen in two pieces, so that one of the two letters which marked it was wrapped round the child, whilst the other remained in my possession, I rang the bell and fled with all speed. A fortnight after, I was at Rogliano, and I said to Assunta, "Console thyself, sister. Israel is dead, but he is avenged." She demanded what I meant, and when I had recounted all to her, "Giovanni," said Assunta, "you should have brought this child with you. We would have replaced the parents it has lost, have called it Benedetto, and then, in consequence of this good action, God would have blessed us." In reply, I gave her the half of the linen I had kept in order to reclaim him if we became rich. "What letters were marked on the linen?" said Monte Cristo. "An H and an N, surmounted by a baron's coronet."
"By heaven, Monsieur Bertuccio, you make use of heraldic terms. Where did you study heraldry?"
"In your service, Excellency, where everything is learned."
"Go on. I am curious to know two things. What are they, Monsignor? What became of this little boy? For I think you told me it was a boy, Monsieur Bertuccio."
"No, Excellency, I do not recollect telling you that."
"I thought you did. I must have been mistaken." "No, you were not, for it was, in reality, a little boy. But your Excellency wished to know two things. What was the second?"
"The second was the crime of which you were accused when you asked for a confessor, and the Abbé Busoni came to visit you at your request in the prison at Nîmes."
"The story will be very long, Excellency."
"What matter? You know I take but little sleep, and I do not suppose you are very much inclined for it either." Bertuccio bowed and resumed his story.
"Partly to drown the recollections of the past that haunted me, partly to supply the wants of the poor widow, I eagerly returned to my trade of smuggler, which had become more easy since that relaxation of the laws which always follows a revolution. The southern districts were ill-watched in particular, in consequence of the disturbances that were perpetually breaking out in Avignon, Nîmes, or Uzès. We profited by the kind of respite government gave us to make friends everywhere. Since my brother's assassination in the streets of Nîmes, I had never entered the town. The result was, the innkeeper with whom we were connected, seeing we would no longer come to him, was forced to come to us, and had established a branch to his inn, on the road from Bellegarde to Beaucaire, at the sign of the Pont de Gare. We had thus, both on the side of Aigues-Mortes, Martigues, or at Bouc, a dozen places where we left our goods, and where, in case of necessity, we concealed ourselves from the gendarmes and custom-house officers. Smuggling is a profitable trade when a certain degree of vigour and intelligence is employed. As for myself, brought up in the mountains, I had a double motive for fearing the gendarmes and custom-house officers, as my appearance before the judges would cause an inquiry, and an inquiry always looks back into the past. And in my past life, they might find something far more grave than the selling of smuggled cigars or barrels of brandy without a permit. So, preferring death to capture, I accomplished the most astonishing deeds, and which, more than once, showed me that the too great care we take of our bodies is the only obstacle to the success of those projects which require a rapid decision and vigorous and determined execution. In reality, when you have once devoted your life, you are no longer the equal of other men, or rather, other men are no longer your equals, and whosoever has taken this resolution feels his strength and resources doubled. "Philosophy, Monsieur Bertuccio," interrupted the Count. "You have done a little of everything in your life."
"Oh, Excellency, no, no, but philosophy at 10:30 at night is somewhat late. yet I have no other observation to make, for what you say is correct, which is more than can be said for all philosophy. My journeys became more and more extensive and more productive. Asunta took care of all, and our little fortune increased. One day, as I was setting off on an expedition, "Go," said she, "at your return I will give you a surprise." I questioned her, but in vain. She would tell me nothing, and I departed. Our expedition lasted nearly 6 weeks. We had been to Lucca to take in oil, to Leghorn for English cottons, and we ran our cargo without opposition and returned home full of joy. When I entered the house, the first thing I beheld in the centre of Asunta's chamber was a cradle that might be called sumptuous compared with the rest of the furniture, and in it a baby of 7 or 8 months old. I uttered a cry of joy, the only moments of sadness I had known since the assassination of the Procureur du Roi were caused by the recollection that I had abandoned this child. For the assassination itself, I had never felt any remorse. Poor Asunta had guessed all. She had profited by my absence, and furnished with the half of the linen, and having written down the day and hour at which I had deposited the child at the hospital, had set off for Paris, and had reclaimed it. No objection was raised, and the infant was given up to her. Ah, I confess, Monsieur Le Comte, when I saw this poor creature sleeping peacefully in its cradle, I felt my eyes filled with tears. "Ah, Asunta," cried I, "you are an excellent woman, and heaven will bless you." "This," said Monte Cristo, "is less correct than your philosophy. It is only faith." "Alas, your excellency is right," replied Bertuccio, "and God made this infant the instrument of our punishment. Never did a perverse nature declare itself more prematurely, and yet it was not owing to any fault in his bringing up. He was a most lovely child, with large blue eyes of that deep colour that harmonizes so well with the general fairness of the complexion. Only his hair, which was too light, gave his face a most singular expression, which redoubled the vivacity of his look and the malice of his smile. Unfortunately, there is a proverb that says that red is either altogether good or altogether bad. The proverb was but too correct as regarded Benedetto, and even in his infancy he manifested the worst disposition. It is true that the indulgences of his mother encouraged him. This child, for whom my poor sister would go to the town 5 or 6 leagues off to purchase the earliest fruits and the most tempting sweetmeats, preferred to the grapes of Parma or the preserves of Genoa the chestnuts stolen from a neighbour's orchard or the dried apples in his loft, when he could eat as well of the nuts and apples that grew in my garden. One day, when Benedetto was about 5 or 6, our neighbour, Wasilio, who, according to the custom of the country, never locked up his purse or his valuables, for, as your excellency knows, there are no thieves in Corsica, complained that he had lost a louis out of his purse. We thought he must have made a mistake in counting his money, but he persisted in the accuracy of his statement. One day, Benedetto, who had been gone from the house since morning, to our great anxiety, did not return until late in the evening, dragging a monkey after him, which he said he had found chained to the foot of a tree. For more than a month past, the mischievous child, who knew not what to wish for, had taken it into his head to have a monkey. A boatman who had passed by Rogliano, and who had several of these animals whose tricks had greatly diverted him, had, doubtless, suggested this idea to him. "Monkeys are not found in our woods, chained to trees," said I. "Confess how you obtained this animal." Benedetto maintained the truth of what he had said, and accompanied it with details that did more to his imagination than to his veracity. I became angry. He began to laugh. I threatened to strike him, and he made 2 steps backwards. "You cannot beat me," said he. "You have no right, for you are not my father." We never knew who had revealed this fatal secret, which we had so carefully concealed from him. However, it was this answer, in which the child's whole character revealed itself, that almost terrified me, and my arm fell without touching him. The boy triumphed,
and this victory rendered him so audacious that all the money of Assunta, whose affection for him seemed to increase as he became more unworthy of it, was spent in prices she knew not how to contend against, and follies she had not the courage to prevent. When I was at Rogliano, everything went on